This is KHSU.
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 KHSU. Now, here's Brenda and Eric.
Good evening. Yes, this is Thursday Night Talk, and I'm your host, Brenda Starr. And first of all, I'd like to say, rest in peace, Leonard Cohen. And we know you are dancing to the end of love, which is, might be the theme for this week as well. Now, my guest tonight is my colleague and fellow host of Thursday Night Talk, Eric Kirk. And we will be taking your calls, because if you heard our promo, we're here to talk about that we had a record number of registered voters. There's voter fatigue and there's call of voter fraud. So we'd like to know what the voters had to say. And we welcome your calls, because we will be talking about the after vote of a nation. 826-4805, our 800 number if you're out of the area, 640-5911. You can also text us if you don't want to be on air. That's 492-5478. Eric, welcome.
Thank you. I wish it was happier times.
I know. I want to go back a little of why I wanted to invite you here this evening. I've been listening to you talk about politics for a while. You and I are very kindred spirits, yet we've never sat down and talked politics, the two of us.
No, we haven't.
And so I know we have a lot of similarities. People who heard me talk about this probably ad infinitum, but, you know, I started out as 8 years old when my mother told me I took politics too seriously. And I said, I said, Mom, they tell you how deep you can bury your dead. And I think it's because my grandfather had died, and I must have heard the adults talking about, oh, we got to do this, you know, because back then the death would be, the body would be at home. And some people just wanted to bury them in the backyard. So the government had to do with a lot. And
well, that's interesting because my first experience with politics really came when I was 8 as well. I was 1972, and the returns were coming in on the presidential election, and I walked in to my mom, my dad, my aunt, my uncle, all just glum sitting in the living room in the dark, staring at the TV screen as the results were coming in with McGovern and Nixon. And I asked my mom, what are you watching? And she says, a monster movie. That was my introduction to politics. And I became very fascinated with it. And I learned that that Nixon had taken 49 out of the 50 states. And for some reason, I just thought that just meant Democrats could never win again. Yet 4 years later, Jimmy Carter beat Ford, who was Nixon's replacement. And I was like, oh, God, boy, what, how did, and that's how I sort of got interested. How does it swing this widely? Well, I hadn't, you know, from 8 years old to 12 years old, I'm not reading all that much about Watergate. I knew little bits and pieces of it and what that all meant. And I did know about the Vietnam War. I didn't realize it was unpopular with everybody. I knew it was unpopular where I lived. But
and where'd you grow up?
Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area. And I, although I did at one point in 1976 when I was watching television and somebody called himself a conservative, I didn't realize that people actually called themselves that. I thought it was a derogatory term that, you know, people like my family would call people. I didn't realize they would actually identify themselves that way. So I was fascinated. So I figured that's where I got interesting that, wow, people really think differently that way. And of course, I learned also I had a lot of family members who thought very differently, and that actually our wing of the family was actually a minority among Catholic, military, very conservative people. So, it's a long way. After that, I just took interest in elections and politics and have been watching it for a long time.
Did you? Because when I was 8 years old and got into it, it was Kennedy. Mm-hmm. So by 72, I was able to vote. And actually was walking precincts for Shirley Chisholm.
Mm.
So
oh, yeah.
This year was very important to me.
Right.
For all those reasons. And and also, you know, I've done quite a few shows on women candidates, on the breaking the glass ceiling. Talking about the over 200 women who have already run for president, just no one on a major party.
Right. Although she was running as a Democrat, right? That was Shirley Chisholm?
Well, she was the woman as Shirley Chisholm, because, you know, remember the women's movement was just starting. Bella Abzug and Shirley Chisholm called her the woman candidate, and McGovern was the male candidate. So even progressive feminists couldn't really wrap themselves around just calling her president. Mm-hmm. She's a presidential candidate. And in 1964, because I was wondering, you grew up in the Bay Area. I grew up back east, and we used to have auditoriums every Wednesday, the younger kids be in the front, the older kids all the way in the back. And we did lots of different things. We did debates. We did, everybody had to do the current events. And, you know, so we have that. So we were engaged in citizenry.
Yeah.
And I had to be George McGovern, and I really wanted to be Margaret Chase Smith. So it's we have not come a long way, baby. We really haven't come a long way.
No, I mean, it's, you know, the little trickles in there. Although I did my first debate in high school, I took the position against the Briggs Initiative, Proposition mm-hmm. 6, mm-hmm. and I remember. It really actually opened things up to me, because I argued, you know, well, this would in effect bar Michelangelo from teaching, right? How ridiculous would that be? And a friend of mine, you know, within the next couple of days, hands me a note and says, and I don't want you to read it till you get home. Of course, I wait till it's around the corner, right? I'm not going to wait till that. And he said, I am what Michelangelo was.
So, personally, okay, came out to me. From a distance.
I'm 14 and he's 15. And that was, at that time, that was a really brave thing to do in high school. You know, I mean, it was just, he handed me his life, basically. Mm-hmm. And I was so moved by that. And that's where I realized, you know, that really started to think about, this is really important, and God, I hope this thing doesn't pass. And it didn't, thanks in part to Harvey Milk, who really campaigned against it. And, you know, as people realized, even people who are homophobic realized how crazy that was, that all teachers should be banned who were homosexual or advocated homosexuality, whatever that meant.
It was quite a big deal.
Oh, it was a scary thing.
So speaking of propositions, because we do want to get into the big lump that's in everyone's throat and hearts right now, which is the presidential election, and President-elect Trump. I think that's the first time I've actually really said that. President-elect Trump.
Yes.
But let's start with some local stuff.
It's not formal yet. The Electoral College has not been taken, but anyways.
Oh, that's true. Well, you know, there is a, well, you know, we live in Humboldt County, so anyways. Let's come up with some conspiracies, but I'm sure we could do that by the end of the evening. But as far as our local, you know, we've kind of have been usurped by the electoral voting this year, mm-hmm. and that's always the sexy one, and it gets a lot of attention, and because we're inundated for so long. But let's start with some of the measures, and let's do grassroots. So we'll start from V.
Proposition V.
Measure V.
Measure V was local rent control.
Local rent control.
Rent control in Humboldt County. I didn't think it would pass, personally, because it's just, you know, I think of Humboldt County with a lot of liberal elements to it, but there's a real kind of property rights tinge to it, and it's kind of libertarianism, even in the progressivism. But it passed by convincing measure, it's limited, of course, to mobile homes, but why it could be more successful than San Francisco, say, in regulating rent prices. In San Francisco, they never passed a vacancy rent control, which means, right. You know, you could live in there for 20 years and you can minimize the rent increases, but the minute you move, the landlords jack it up, and so you have these ridiculous situations of one person in a building with rent $600 a month and a similar flat being charged $3,000 a month, and the rest, without the vacancy rent control, the prices go up anyways, you know, and other than the few people that hold out and live in the same place for decades. So this actually incorporates vacancy control. It's got a number of provisions, some formulas, cost of living increases, and some ability for landlords if their costs are more than that. I mean, it's a workable proposition, we hope, and it passed. And
The Democratic slate included voting for mm-hmm. Measure V, yeah. and I think that people just did that.
They did that, but they also had the help from a new organization, or the North Coast People's Alliance, and they were headed up by a powerhouse of a woman, Tamara McFarland. You're going to be hearing that name. She ran the Bernie campaign, and Bernie did better in Humboldt County than any county in the state, over 70% of the vote in Humboldt County. And she ran this one, and then in Eureka, she ran Yes on Measure P, which is the ward voting, which had a lot of opposition from the old guard, political guard. And she ran an upstart young man named Austin Allison, who has not been in Eureka very long, and his opponent John Fullerton was touting experience and community, deep community roots, usually the kind of thing that wins in Humboldt County. But Austin won by about 10 percentage points, and at least as they're counting, they're still counting. And Measure P passed as well, which really surprised me. Because
did you why that surprised you?
Well, there's always resistance to it. There's resistance to change. The opposition had kind of a clever thing about how you're giving up votes because you'll only get to vote for one, as opposed to now you get to vote for five, and how it could divide the cities. There's a lot of the similar stuff that was raised against district elections in San Francisco. And we just brought up Harvey Milk. District elections got him and Carol Ruth Silver and Dan White elected, and then people said, oh, that's what happens.
Yeah.
And they were without it, but then they got it again. And in the 1990s, and they still maintain some progressive politics, even with the Google takeover of the city. It's a very interesting thing, but it passed, and I'm really, we've had so many, the progressives have had so many losses over the past decade locally, but it looks like there may have turned a corner for local progressive politics, thanks in part to this organization. And again, I think you'll be hearing the name Tamara McFarland for years.
Well, it certainly has grassroots activism had a major rebirth this year.
Mm-hmm.
Had a major rebirth this year, and it went full tilt boogie because it got into the presidential election.
Right.
And that's the only kind of trickle down I like, mm-hmm. Which then does affect your local elections. Anything else surprise you? Locally?
Locally, not so much. Everything else, I guess Measure U going down defeat surprised me a little bit, although I think people are just getting tired of pushing sales taxes. They're regressive, and it's really for things that should be covered on the state and federal level.
Yes.
And so everything's being thrown to the locals. I think people are just saying, how many more taxes can we pass?
Yeah.
And, that was and again, sales taxes are regressive. When you're getting money from the state and federal, it's based on income taxes, which are in theory at least progressive, not always. I mean, we know certain people don't pay taxes at all, but still.
And perhaps that's why this county needs additional taxes.
Yeah, it definitely needs more money coming from the state, but it's just, but then probably the whole state needs more money.
Oh, the whole country does, and which is yet another thing to talk about in presidential politics about money and services and why people don't have things, an area that they blame candidates and parties for. But it really is a matter of money, whether you're running or whether you're sitting or whether you're going in a pothole. It's all about that. Now let's talk about 54 for a minute.
54 or 64?
Oh, 64.
You want the marijuana? 54 is interesting too, but 64, we had 17 propositions, so it's easy to get it mixed up. 64 is the marijuana one. A lot of people thought there would be more opposition locally, but it passed in Humboldt County by about the same proportion as statewide, which I think was about 10%. So far, and it does legalize recreational marijuana.
Well, I was telling people, I said, I've been waiting since 1972 when I could vote for a woman to be president and vote to legalize marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
And at least one of those things happened. So
yeah. Yeah, I did. The theory was that there was going to be a lot of local opposition because the more legal it gets, the harder it is on our economy, corporatization and all that. But I think people are just tired of the crime involved in it and the busts and the long sentences in people's memory. I think people just want to say, whatever is going to happen economically, we need to get there. We need to do
it. Well, 215, Prop 215 happened really a long time ago. We've had a long time to look at that service delivery system. And I don't know if people like that or not. And, you know, it's even legal marijuana is not going to preclude people from going to people who know people.
Right. There's always going to be an underground economy, just like there is for cigarettes and everything else.
Exactly.
But it passed. Actually, some very progressive things. California did mostly progressive things. A couple of things, maybe not, like the death penalty. Once again, we failed to ban the death penalty.
I know. That surprised me.
Yeah, it did too. But we failed in 2012 too. I think there's just an element out there that still is just nervous about that kind of change. Mm-hmm. And we're not sure if the opposing measure passed, the one that will limit the appeals and make it even more likely that we mess up with the death penalty. But it may go down by the time it's done. It was within one percentage point.
I'm going to ask you a question with a rather broad brush.
Sure.
And one thing I know for sure about 64 is even though it passed, people can't even get permits until 2018. So what I don't like about propositions, because, you know, I think that the legislators should do their job. They should be legislating.
Sure.
But so we've been asked to put some stuff and we put it together. And typically it doesn't even start until not only the next fiscal year, but the fiscal year after that. Is that relevant for most of the propositions that were passed?
Not everything. Some of them passed instantaneously. You know, certain things will pass depending on the nature of it. Certain things might take a while because you have to get regulations, but I believe that once the vote is certified, some of the they're all actually law, and but as to whether in a practical matter they go into effect
January 1st,
it's hard to say. Some propositions have been right away, and I'm trying to think of what they've been, but it says in them when they actually go into effect, because sometimes there needs to be a transition, sometimes the state needs, it depends if the state needs to gear up for implementation.
Yeah, if it requires a board or some kind of overview.
Right, something along those lines. I didn't really study them to see which ones would have happened. I imagine Prop 53, if it had passed, would have been instantaneous, which would have required a statewide approval of local projects that are funded by bonds, even if they're self-funding, you know, and which was ridiculous. Why, you know, if it's a fiscal issue, why do that unless, you know, there's an error that way? And most people saw it as ridiculous, and they rejected it. That would have gone into effect right away because it didn't require any particular implementation, I think. But it didn't pass. The cigarette tax will probably take some time to implement. And the other one, though, is it just doesn't go away. It extends, Prop 55 extends the millionaire tax another 12 years.
That seems to be something that happens a lot, is that you have a tax and you just keep extending it.
Right, and that happens. Well, although this one, people are like saying, you know, first of all, the income taxes of people that wealthy have been going down steadily since the 1950s. It's about time. We should just keep it up. Keep that one up. You know, people with that much money have much more of a stake in society running well. They should foot the bill. You know, it's their wealth that's being protected by the infrastructure. So, you know, so there's that feeling. But yeah, sometimes taxes do get extended, although it was the tax break got extended on the federal level, the Bush tax thing, you know. So it just depends on it. But people were saying, well, the politicians are breaking their promises. And it's like, no, they're not. We're breaking the promise. The people are at this point. And that's what I think the propositions are good for. But I agree with you that there's certain propositions that are on that are very complicated that probably should be left to the legislature, who can take in testimony from the various interests and try to, you know, balance it. We can't do that. You know, most of us don't even have time to read that telephone book of a thing that they gave
us. It puts a burden on, but, you know, it's about... but that's about educating people and voters, and maybe someday we'll get to do that with between social media and the plethora of media that we have out there.
Yeah.
Although I don't know if that's grammatically Latin correct, the plethora of media.
My view is that the material terms of a proposition should be able to be fit on one page, or it shouldn't be on the ballot. You know,
I like that. I like that a lot.
Yeah, if it's a simple thing, and all it has to say is, kind of like with Prop 64, the legislature is empowered to enforce this new law, you know, in the spirit of it. And then if they veer off, the court decides whether or not they're doing that. That's, you know, and that way the legislature has the discretion to be able to fill in the blanks. If that had been done for medical marijuana, we might have avoided a lot of problems and a lot of ambiguities. But, you know, anyways.
Here we are 20 years later. You're listening to Thursday Night Talk here in KHSU. I'm Brenda Starr, your host this evening, and Eric Kirk is here with me tonight. And we're discussing the after vote of a nation. Your comments, feelings, questions, concerns are welcome. Please call at 826-4805. Our toll-free number is 800-640-5911. If you don't want to be on the air, you can text us, and Michael will take that and let us know what you would like to say or ask. And that number is 492-5478, and we welcome your calls. Part of what I wanted to do this evening was reminiscent. I was listening to our station that we both volunteered at before. Now you volunteer.
I'm sort of a radio slut, radio station slut.
Okay. You know, I don't know if you can say that word here, baby. I might slap you in the face, but that's all right. That's all right. I don't want to hear no whores or sluts. Not for a while. Not after this year.
That's a good point.
I know. It's just, you know, the hair is in the back of my head. Doesn't even matter who says it. But that's just my, that's just an indication of how everything has affected me.
Well, hopefully if they keep them on Xanax for 4 years, it won't say.
But on K-Mud, there was a programmer who didn't show up. And what Jeanette did was, it was 90 minutes of people calling in to share their feelings about how they felt about this election. Mm-hmm. Because, personally, it's been very hard. I shared with you before we got on air about how my election night went. I paid practically no attention to local. I was so consumed by the drama that was going on. And my friends from all over the country are texting me, and I feel like I have to be the container of optimism and hope. Oh, well, it's only that. Well, it's just, well, Florida, well, Broward County wasn't counted yet. Yeah. Well, it's North Carolina. It's going to be a long night, right, until you gradually just spiral down into a lump. So the next day, a friend of mine who hadn't texted at all said, can we talk? She says, I think I need to sit Shiva for the death of humanity. And I don't say that facetiously, and neither did she, but that's what it feels like. It feels like I need a bowl of water to wash my hands before I go into the house of where I experienced that death. Margaret from Garberville, welcome to Thursday Night Talk.
Thanks. Hi, Brenda.
Hi.
Hi, Margaret.
Thanks for doing the show. I appreciate it because it kind of unraveled some of the stuff that has been raveled up and knotted up for a bit of a time now. But I'm really wondering about the Electoral College, and if you can shed some light on that in terms that even I could understand, I would really appreciate it. And I'll take that off the air.
How do you mean? Explaining it?
Why do I vote and my vote for Hillary doesn't count, even though she won the popular vote?
Mm-hmm.
And the electoral vote.
Sometimes it feels like that.
It does. But, it just seems like, what are we doing?
Well, so where were you in 2001 when this happened the last time?
I tried to understand.
Yeah,
it goes back. It goes back. You know, it's about the smaller states and having representation, but it does go back a long time.
It goes back to colonial post-colonial revolutionary America. People were afraid that the smaller states, the more rural states, were afraid that they would lose influence. Also, it was one of the things that some people will tell you is that we don't live in a democracy, we live in a republic. Mm-hmm. And a republic is simply people who are chosen to rule it. We don't self-rule. Propositions are an exception. That's direct democracy. And so the idea was that there needed to be some kind of protection so that if the popular vote, even in a state, went one way, these electors who were virtuous citizens chosen for their virtue would be the ones who would make the judgment for us. And in the beginning, it wasn't even certain that they would have to vote for the candidate that won. They could make up their own minds. The vote was just an advisory thing. Technically speaking, it's still that way, although we were learning that there was somebody in Washington State who was not going to vote for Hillary Clinton if she was elected, and or if she won the race up there, and she did, actually, and we'll see what happens. But that state actually has a fine for electoral college people who vote differently.
However, that one vote still would have would have been subtracted from Hillary Clinton's.
That's
from,
right.
From them. So
yeah, it would have been.
So $2,000 vote for him would have meant nothing.
In 1984, there was an electoral person who voted who could not bring himself to vote for Reagan. He was a black electoral person, Republican, but he could not bring himself. So he actually voted for it. So Mondale actually got one more electoral vote that doesn't match. You know, it happens every once in a while. It's been a long time since it was significant that it could actually have the potential to affect a race or a state. But that's how it works. They're the ones that the electors do it, and the legislature is supposed to empower them. And technically speaking, states don't even have to hold elections. I mean, you know, right. Under those rules.
Well, is that outdated now?
Well, I think so.
I think so too.
I think it's crazy that, you know, the majority of voters are disenfranchised. This is the third time it's happened.
That's the way it feels, absolutely. Yeah. And it's very discouraging. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I'm a committed voter, but I'll tell you, it's discouraging.
Well, the other thing that I find, and I wonder if you find discouraging as well, Margaret, is that by the time our polls are closed, they've already called the election. That is something that has always bothered me. We don't have early voting. The only early voting we have is the absentee ballot,
right.
But that's not really an indicator of anything.
And it was really bad in 1980 when Carter gave his concession speech before our polls even closed.
I know, and that bothers me. And I thought last time that they were taking some steps to not announce the East Coast until our polls were closed.
Oh, they can't help themselves.
They can't, because somebody's going to do it, and it's going to be all over the internet. It's really hard. It was, you know, it actually wasn't officially over, although I felt like it was. But it wasn't. The media hadn't called Wisconsin yet. I think that was the final blow when they finally decided. But it was really looking bad.
Because she had no way to win if she lost Wisconsin. Even though there are still states, Margaret, that have not been the Electoral College is still outstanding. Well, because not only that, they don't ratify that until what? Sometime
December.
Later this month or December?
December.
Yeah, December. Yeah.
Ratify what? The electoral vote?
Yes.
Yeah, each state ratifies its vote, and I think it's supposed to be in with the federal on a certain date in December. I don't remember what it is. I remember when the whole thing was going with in Florida back in 2000 that they were the part of the Supreme Court was trying to get it all done before that deadline came, or Florida's votes wouldn't count at all.
So yeah. How many electorals are there? Does that go by population as well?
Yes.
Roughly, but there's a lot of questions about it. But yes, roughly.
Yeah, I think we should eliminate that.
Yeah, well,
or they should give us three times more.
Or a parliamentary system, proportional representation would strengthen third parties, all kinds of issues there. Then you could vote for them, because if together you got enough votes to overcome it, really doesn't matter, you know. So
yeah,
it's just.
Right.
Well, you know, those things, you bring up a very good question and concern, because I think that there are more and more people who are looking at that. And what I've heard from a lot of young people is that they're very suspicious of this deep, dark, opaque system, mm-hmm. which really goes towards apathy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you voted and you never win, you get apathetic.
Right.
If you vote and you think it doesn't count, you get apathetic. If you vote or you're thinking of voting and then you realize, oh, my vote is really that person who's the elector and I don't know who that is and I don't get to vote for them, it creates apathy.
Mm-hmm.
But I think my feeling is that's a strategy. It's a strategy, just like it's a strategy to have not had people's votes protected this year for the first time in 50
right.
years.
Right, the Voting Rights Act was gutted, and they in the Deep South they closed about 800 plus polling places.
I heard about that. And I was interested in that because I didn't know what that was or meant our voting rights?
Well, the Voting Rights Act, there were a number of places that were on suspicion lists. They have to report and they had to, that they were making progress, that they were making sure that there were no impediments.
Counting soap bubbles, et cetera, et cetera.
All that kind of stuff, to especially in light of the black vote. And they were under watch. They had to basically justify any changes that they made, any poll closures. But the Supreme Court ruled, said, oh, we don't have those problems anymore.
Oh.
We don't need that.
Mm-hmm.
So that it was took out that part of the Voting Rights Act. So it's they could still, in theory, sue if they find out that there were shenanigans. And there are some issues. For instance, in there were long lines, and it's heartening to see long lines. But when you see long lines, it generally means that there are too few polling places. And, you know, as you're looking at it and you're seeing, okay, great, look at all those people who are going to vote, you have to bear in mind that there are people driving by who say, I can't wait in line that long. I got kids I got to pick up, you know.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So it's a really bad thing, and it's hard to quantify because nobody knows who drives by and doesn't come in to vote. So it's a tough one, and it may have had an impact on this election. Early voting in Ohio was much less effective this time around because their rules that they passed said that each county only had to have one voting place. Well, so Columbus, there's a video on YouTube of this long line that took 9 minutes to walk from one end to the other, and but it's the same as any of the rural counties. And you know, Ohio and Pennsylvania, some of the reasons that they went was the proportional voter turnout in the rural counties was much higher compared to the urban counties this time around. And Pennsylvania has no early voting. And, you know, I almost think early voting should be mandated unless they're going to give us a holiday.
Well, speaking of, that's what I think. It should be mandated as a holiday. When I was younger, it wasn't a holiday, but the bars were closed.
Yeah.
The bars were closed, and you couldn't sell certain things until the polls were closed.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how important it felt like then.
Well, let's get rid of the electorate vote and have our vote count again. I'm kind of fed up with that.
Well, the other part of that that goes hand in hand with the Electoral College is the fact that each state gets to determine, and that's done by an elected official. Let's just look at Catherine Harris from Florida at the time of 2000. You know, that was Bush's right-hand woman as far as making sure, I was in Florida for Thanksgiving visiting relatives, and there was two channels where they just had them counting the hanging chads. Two channels just for people to watch that, and then there was also the stopping the counting and all that stuff.
Uh-huh.
But it was her, as there are other officials in each state that get to decide how that goes, and that's that's a biased position.
Unfortunately, it's going to be really hard to change the Electoral College vote. Would require a constitutional convention, and there isn't a lot of energy for it right now. It's been proposed, but it doesn't. There's always bills in committee that never make it out of committee. But one thing we could do, because one of the problems I have is that it comes down to the battleground states, and all of the electioneering is there. All the attention goes to those states. Mm-hmm. But if everything was done at least proportionally,
right.
You know, rather than winner takes all in California, for instance, you know, it's good for Democrats these days to have it winner take all. But you know, what if it was that, you know, you got is the Electoral College votes proportionate to your to how many votes you get, maybe rounded up in favor of the winner. You know, and that would also allow for a third parties to maybe get in a few votes here and get on the map. I mean, it just at least that's there's only two states that have that, and it's Nebraska and Maine.
Well, let's talk about Maine for a second, because I believe in plurality vote. I wish we had a plurality government, because that would mean that very thing. You have your representation. I used to do poll work when my son was little, and at that time there were 7 to 10 different political parties. Now, if we were able to get true representation, I'm a Green Party person and I'm going to vote for that, and based on the number of votes, that's how many representatives you have. You actually have reflective people who voted for that person. They're reflecting, represented in the government. Now, that's a major coup. But hand in hand, Maine has beginning, it was a choice voting, it was called. And I'm thinking, was this the beginning of plurality? Voters decide whether to change the existing statewide voting system to rank choice voting, otherwise known as instant runoff voting. Ranked choice voting allows voters to rank candidates in order of preference. Mm-hmm. Somehow that does skew stuff, and I would think that somebody who is not either a Democrat or a Republican might have a chance to go ahead and have it might be more egalitarian in the long run.
Right.
Well, don't we have that here?
No, we don't. San Francisco's got something called the instant runoff, where you get to have your first and second and third choices. And it's sort of convoluted how it works, but it's that way you don't have to have a runoff later. And you can, if you put your first choice, then you know all of those first choices get eliminated until somebody has a majority. And I forget exactly how it works.
But the Senate, but you're right. Look at the Senate race. We had two women Democrat candidates for the United States Senate. So, no other state had that.
No other state had that. That happens because, we just have the top two vote-getters get to go, and probably in California soon enough, there'll probably be no Republicans in any of the statewide positions. That's the way it is. There would be local races in which there are only two Republicans or only two Democrats.
But it does give way for other parties to rise up.
That's the important thing. I'm going to sign off, guys. Thanks for
All right, thanks Margaret.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Oh, we have a text.
Michael.
Thanks, guys. This one's from Kirsten in Bayside. But before we get to that, we actually got a call a little bit ago saying the protests have formed in Old Town Eureka.
Oh.
And
okay.
The text from Kirsten, thanks for texting us. She wanted to know if you guys knew anything about or were able to comment on the Republican cross-check program, which is suspected of removing millions of people from voter rolls without notifying them.
Oh yeah, well
in different states have different rules about that, and I think North Carolina they were showing up and with big lists saying you need to take those off, and they were like saying because these people are all dead, and then one guy came and said I'm not dead, I'm on that list, you know, and the and actually the federal judge was appalled with that and overturned them. But yeah, there is cleaning the rolls off is a typical suppression method. It worked in Florida for Bush in 2000.
And North Carolina this year got a lot of interesting things happening that way. There was the 100-year-old woman who had been denied. 100-year-old woman, really? You're going to say
voted in every election.
And also people who say they lost their house due to the housing crisis that that we were faced with when Obama came into office. Mm-hmm. And eventually, a lot of people lost their houses. So if they didn't, if they lost their house or if their house was in foreclosure, they said, well, you can't vote because you don't have a permanent address.
Yeah, the Voting Rights Act needs to be restored. Not going to happen.
I have
anytime soon.
I have a hope and a wish and a prayer that President Barack Obama, the young man, and we know he's not going to be a Supreme Court judge. I don't think he wants that. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people thought, he'd be the head of the UN. Well, they already got that person, et cetera, et cetera. I wonder if the best thing that would serve him to do for this country is to go over our voting, is to deal with how we vote in this country, and to try to present proposals to make that a more egalitarian process for us.
It'll be interesting to see what he does.
I imagine we're
going to hear. I don't think he's going to go private like Bush. You know, I imagine we're going
to. Well, Bush had to go underground. Come on, private, please.
Yeah, I know. I mean, you know, when everybody says the best ex-president is Jimmy Carter because of all the great things he's done, Habitat for Humanity, election watching and everything. And I expect suspect Obama's going to be in that same vein. We're going to miss him.
Yeah.
You know, just his humor, his thoughtfulness. I had a lot of criticism of him. I really disagreed with how he handled a lot of stuff, how he caved to Republicans and things like that. But, you know, it's just, but to have a thoughtful
To have a statesman.
Yeah.
To
we're not going to have that for a while.
Yeah.
At least 4 years.
So speaking of Republicans, did they ride to victory with fear, ignorance, bigotry, and smear?
You know, I think there's a lot of that, but I actually think this is where the Democrats really have to look at ourselves. And I am a Democrat. I'm able to say that now because the election has passed, so I can talk about it without, you know, I can
endorse. Well, you
could
say you just can't tell somebody who to vote for.
Right, exactly. And nobody's on the ticket right now. So anyways, but I think what the Democrats really have to do is where they lost was the Rust Belt. And that shocked everybody because these are states that have been Democratic strongholds for a long time. Unions used to get their people out. They'd volunteer. They'd do phone calling. They'd work for campaigns. They would drive and bus all of their members and people in the neighborhoods and the rest. We've lost them because we've lost a way of life. You know, the post-war, there were a lot of factories, particularly around the auto industry, but around other industries as well, that has been gutted. And everybody blames the trade agreements. And yes, the trade agreements not having labor standards has been a factor. But it actually began before then. It was beginning actually in the 1970s. And actually since 1972, I think the American worker has received a real dollar wage in the aggregate twice in that amount of time, 1996 and 1997.
Well, we got into union-busting time come
union
the
70s. Union-busting, Patco, when Reagan fired the Patco workers, mm-hmm. and the union movement really became
deregulation.
And you'd hear all these people saying, oh, unions were important at one time, but we don't need them anymore. Wages are too high. That was always the thing. And the wages have been going down steadily, and the factories have been closing, and places like Flint, Michigan, which used to be sort of the American dream kind of place. And this was happening before NAFTA because we know it because Michael Moore did a very famous movie called Roger and Me about how things were closing and moving to other countries then. And the Democrats used to stand up for them. And used to have it. And one of the things we noted was John Edwards first, and then Bernie Sanders this last time, were the first candidates to actually raise what I call class issues.
Oh, yeah. They talked about poor
time.
People.
They
Absolutely.
Talked about poor people. That's something that's really been missing with candidates since 1984. Mondale did it. Obviously didn't work out so well for Mondale. And we really need to find a way to reclaim it because these people are hurting. These people have, you know, their kids are getting into meth. The communities are just gutted from all the way from the Appalachian corridor to from the coal country, which is also in trouble, all the way to Minnesota, actually, which Trump did better in Minnesota than Republicans have done in a long time. The Democrats have to find a way to reintegrate that. And I think most of these people know that we have their backs economically, they might be more open and willing, like they were during the civil rights movement, to consider the social issues, to address issues of racism, misogyny, and homophobia. But right now, they're just hurting.
And in the 90s, were you a lawyer back then?
I became a lawyer in 1996.
I was a social worker.
Mm-hmm.
I was a social worker, and I did welfare to work programs. And at that point, Bill Clinton was in office. Mm-hmm. And people want to say that, oh, he destroyed the welfare of people. No, what he did, because remember, this was, he got mainstream, and you have to work with both sides of the aisle.
Mm-hmm.
So it had a work requirement in the state of California. But we used to say we had more money than God to help mm-hmm. people then, to right. help people. So it's about social services. It's about retraining. If we had money to train people who had no job skills to get right. jobs, that were getting jobs. However, what was the help to have these families keep these jobs? They needed child care. They needed medical. They needed after-school programs. They needed post-employment services to make those things happen. Training, post-employment services, helping the family requires money. That social money that has been taken away and chipped been gutted since,
well, begin with Reagan, who did the gutting. See, one of the big secrets of Reagan as to how he had such a good economy in the 1980s, a lot of people don't realize this. They say, oh, well, trickle-down economics worked. They didn't. Say's theorem of you take money and you put it in a rich guy's hands and it's automatically going to be made productive. This recession has proved absolutely. They just sit on the money if it's in their best interest until you have to pry it out of them. $15 trillion by some estimates, maybe as much as 20 sitting in hands idly, and because they don't want to invest because there's not a lot of income to be able to sell the goods. Reagan tried trickle-down economics, tried the supply side, as they called. Let's put the money in the hands rather than demand side, which was
Keynesianism. Which George Herbert Walker Bush called voodoo economics.
Which called voodoo economics. It caused a double-dip recession. Okay. Reagan was actually in trouble in 1981. What he did was old-fashioned Keynesian liberal spending, but instead of spending on the social programs like the New Deal, he had Cap Weinberger concoct, and Weinberger has since admitted this myth of Soviet military superiority, which never existed. And all of a sudden, we jacked up the military spending to something like five times what it had been. What people don't realize is by 1984, the deficit that Reagan, by pushing Congress, and Congress wouldn't stand up to him, for these increase in military expenditures, had driven up the debt so much that the debt by 1984 exceeded all the debts prior, dating back all the way to George Washington. He did it through Keynesian spending. Obama has not been allowed to do that.
Well, let's also go back to Bill Clinton, who then, you know, not only created these things, but left his office with a surplus. So the thing, they can be done. It's just, yeah, it's a matter of determination, and it's a matter of the right choices. Now, could President Obama, he had to bail out the banks, he bailed out the auto industry, right, he bailed out a lot of things, and yet Congress would not let him have an infrastructure bill, would not let him have some things that might have put those workers. But let's talk about those workers, because I had a very interesting talk with someone today. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, you know, the infrastructure, and that's going to require money, and that's going to, well, you know, if you cough a lot, someone will call Michael and say that they'll bring you a meal or something, because that's what they did for him. But I want to talk about men and women in elections and what that means. When Obama asked for money to have that, they wouldn't give him the money, okay? Now, part of it was because they wanted to really minimize his presidency and not let him have that. But the other thing now is if the Republicans decide to go ahead and have that, they need a spending bill in order to do that. So they're going to have to raise money. They're going to have to raise somebody taxes to do that. But where do those jobs go to? So because here's my thing. I want, as a woman who's just been gutted by the most disgusting man on earth running for president, who triggered me for how many months? I care about men up in the Rust Belt who will not retrain in order to get a job, and now the jobs are going to go to those guys. This is what this woman was talking to me about. And first I'm like, oh my gosh, but I listened to her and I heard what she had to say. Right. And there's that going on too.
Yeah, although, sorry, we did... The 53% of white women apparently also voted for Trump. I don't know what they're thinking, but they did.
I know what they're thinking. I'm a woman. I know exactly what they're thinking. If I have to hear one more time from somebody who they're putting a microphone, well, you know, should I have just voted for a woman because she's a woman? Well, I'm a woman, and I shouldn't be running for president. It's a full slippery slope. Yeah. It's their own, you know, internalized misogyny. I have internalized homophobia.
When that video came out with Billy Bush or whatever his name is, I thought that immediately disqualified him. I thought the race was over.
You thought that was the last straw.
I thought that would have just done it. I just didn't think that people, men or women, that weren't, you know, totally ideological blinders would vote for him.
It's not about ideology when you're voting for a black man. It's not about ideology when you're voting for a woman. It's not. It's about those nasty names that you hear. Did you go to Washington when the Clintons were president? My son was in junior high school. He came back because he had a camera and he took pictures. Those were disgusting T-shirts then. They're disgusting T-shirts now. And I'm not going to discount or dismiss that.
But when that video came out, it was more than even just degrading talk. He wasn't just talking about women in a disrespectful
sexual predator
manner.
Talk.
It was. They kept referring. The media kept referring to it as vulgar and locker room talk. It's like, no, that wasn't locker room talk. I've heard some disgusting locker room talk. I've never heard anybody brag about sexual assault in a locker room.
Well, I've heard men talk brag about sexual assault when I was in the military. So it does happen.
I know it does happen. But the point is that this is not locker room talk. Is when you use adjectives and things to describe in a disgusting way.
But remember,
disrespectful.
This is the man who said he could stand in the middle of Fifth Annual and kill somebody.
That's
in
right.
His vote. So
what were the choices? That's what
everything.
I kept saying is, well,
yeah.
People were telling me it's locker room talk. I said there's one choice: either he's a sexual predator or he's a lying bragger who wants to be one. You know what? Which one qualifies him as president?
Yeah.
But. By the time it came around, we had the, of course, we haven't even discussed the intervention of the FBI in this election and the constant thing of the WikiLeaks, which, you know, some of them were okay, showed that the culture is elitist and all that.
But how do we know when if WikiLeaks lets something go that someone's hacked, if that's a real email? I mean, that's just another question there.
It was really hard. And it was daily. Every day there was more. She was facing stuff and it just took its toll. And then when the Comey letter came out, which he really should be fired immediately.
How unprecedented is that? Well, I guess he's going to keep his job, though, huh?
All right. We've got,
Jennifer from
Burlingame.
Yes. I think this might be a friend of yours.
Hi, Jennifer.
Yes. Hi, Eric.
How you doing? I haven't heard this voice in about 40 years.
I know. I didn't recognize your voice, to be honest. Okay. I've got an answer to your question about why did white women vote for Trump.
Go ahead,
please. You were just talking about it. I think it has to deal with the issue of being victims of narcissists. As you know, there's been a lot more acknowledgement of women being victims of sexual assault and verbal assault and other kinds of abuses, including the case against the Stanford student who had been removed from Stanford, and the person on the swimming scholarship, actually, that really kind of kicked everything up, I think, was that the whole thing with Bill Cosby. But I think a lot of them, since they've been victimized, they see Trump as the daddy figure or the parental figure that they always wanted to have, saying, yes, I'm going to make these changes to make it better for you. And just like you were saying about the Rust Belt and the Appalachian area and the parts of the South and the Midwest where it's very hard when your resources are taken away from you and you want to listen to anybody who says, I'm going to do this for you. I think that's the real reason why Trump won.
Well, it definitely is one of the reasons, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And because that's what he kept saying. In fact, Clinton, she was trying to criticize him for it. He kept saying, I will do this. I will make a better plan. Whereas she was trying to be, you know, I represent the we. It was the we versus I. And you think that worked in his favor?
Well, it always works in a male's favor when they're going to say, I'm going to take care of you and I bring home the paycheck and I can even lock you in the house and you better be here when I get home. What else is new about that?
Yeah, it's just sad. And being in the bubble of the Bay Area, you know, I think a lot of people in the Bay Area and in California, as well as Oregon and in Washington State, I think we're all pretty mystified because we didn't see this coming. We really didn't think about what it's like in the Midwest or in the South. But
you know, Michael Moore did predict it. He did say...
Oh, I know he did.
He did, because he's from Flint, Michigan.
Right.
And I kind of, you know, it didn't take him seriously.
But it still doesn't, it still begs a question. Why do people vote against their best interest?
Yeah.
Why do people vote against their best interest?
I think a lot of it has to do with their psychological state of mind.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, when, like I said, you take away all the resources, what are people going to have to do to get by?
Well, I worked with battered women for a long time. I worked with women and children for a long time. I was telling you I was a social worker. And, you know, why would a woman go back to that situation? It's that same cycle. It is, Jennifer.
It's the condition they grew up with, and until they learn how to break that, it's just going to keep happening.
I think the only solution to that is we can empathize with them. We need to organize, and we need to educate.
Yeah.
Jennifer, I got another call here. I thank you so much for your call and,
thank you,
and your thoughts.
Very welcome.
Mitch from Brookings, welcome to Thursday Night Talk.
Yes. You can put this under the heading of paranoia strikes deep, but I've got a little problem.
Into your heart, it will seep.
And number one is Trump won with a head count less than the last two Republican nominees got in a losing cause. Get my drift here? Now, another thing is McConnell back in February stated that they were going to block any kind of nominee to the court. And the way he sounded was like it was a lock that there was going to be a Republican president. That's when I started getting paranoid. And then on top of this, the way Trump's attitude was, the entire time was like the lock was in. So what I'm saying is...
You mean with his projections, how he would say it's a rigged system?
Pardon me. Would it be possible that the vote could be suppressed electronically? Like, in other words, was this all settled a year or so ago? I'll leave it there.
Yeah, I don't know. There are a lot of geeks that have looked at that, and I'm not an expert on it, but I there are a lot of progressive people who say it's not as easy as it sounds to rig a system that way.
I think so.
You know,
but yeah. Mitch, yeah. there's another question that you kind of beg, which is, how do we get out of our minds the fact that we know that Russians hacked into John Podesta, into the Democratic, the DNC? Emails that WikiLeaks let them go. How do we get that out of our mind when the FBI would, you know, everybody's saying that except the FBI? How do we, knowing that information, how does that appease any paranoia or illusions that we might have or disillusions that we might have thinking, well, then why can't that happen? Like, just like what you said, why can't that happen then?
I still have a problem with this head count. How did Trump win this election with less votes than the last two nominees did in losing causes? That means that on top of this, between 2008 and 2016, there's a whole lot many more eligible voters in this country. We're talking about somewhere 15, 20 million votes are no longer around.
Yeah.
Well,
I'll tell you, Mitch,
I got a problem with this.
Yeah, well, you know, we all have a lot of problems with everything, and I'm sure there's going to be a lot of books written on it.
McConnell is the head sorcerer of the Republican Party. McConnell runs it all. Back in February, McConnell, you look on that man's face, he knew exactly what was going to go down. And on top of that, there's no way in the world that Trump acted like a buffoon, a clown, the entire summer. He was so confident.
Well, that's his personality. I think that's part of the narcissist's personality. Well, Mitch, I think you should be writing that book for us.
There is. I mean, you know, there's also the possibility that there are people who just at the last minute, because of the way they've been raised, couldn't bring themselves to vote for a woman. You know,
well, let's talk about that, because the one thing that I want to end on is that as a woman, and as a woman who has written in women's names for president for many, many years, and have worked for women to be in the political process, it's a big slap in the face when somebody, and I'm when you have the most viable candidate out there and she can't win, that really begs a question, well, who can? And a lot of it is because she is a woman, because you don't get that much animus. And like I said, the words, the disgusting words, unless it's about misogyny and sexism. But what I'm going to say is, in San Diego County, there was a local city treasurer office holder race. 17,000 votes for a dead man, 11,000 for the woman. Even a dead man is going to beat a woman, Eric. Now, that says a lot right there. You've been listening to Thursday Night Talk. Eric, thanks so much for
being
here.
Thanks
this was great.
For inviting me.
I want to thank Margaret and Jennifer and Mitch for calling in. I want to thank our engineer, Michael, for taking the text. And I want to thank you, the listener. Next month, Eric and I will be here at the end of the month with our other co-hosts, and we're going to be talking about this past year. Until then, peace, frog.
That's right.
You've been listening to Thursday Night Talk on KHSU. Thanks to our host, Brenda Starr, and our guest, Eric Kirk. We love to get feedback on our programs. Please email ThursdayNightTalk@KHSU.org and like our Facebook page, Thursday Night Talk on KHSU. Coming up next week on Thursday Night Talk, Linda Stansberry talks with a diverse panel about how a Trump presidency might affect LGBTQ, immigrant, and women's rights, and how intersectionality can combat apathy. Tune in. And